listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get some healthy and satisfying recipes like everything bagel, hand pies, and more from Julia Tertian. We'll listen to my conversation with Julia from earlier this spring on Food Friday. Now, scientists found rocks from Wisconsin many miles to the west in Wyoming. Their guess is how the rocks traveled 1,000 miles. Dinosaurs. Scientists hypothesize that sauropods, those were gigantic dinosaurs with those super long necks, swallowed the rocks to help them digest food, and then they made their way to Wyoming. Joseph Fredrickson is the director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh. I talked to him in April to learn more about this research, Wisconsin's prehistoric past, and how likely it might have been that dinosaurs may have roamed in our present-day backyards. Here's our conversation. Well, I want to start with this research that prompted this. Now, this is not a sure thing. There's some argument about whether this is really the real deal here. But tell us about this idea that we had dinosaurs eat rocks, eat Wisconsin rocks, and take them to Wyoming.
Yeah, so it's actually a really neat study that was done in the Morrison Formation of Wyoming, which is dated to about 150 million years ago. And these are rocks contain fossils of some of the most charismatic dinosaurs around, including Allosaurus, the meat-eating dinosaur, Stegosaurus, and the long-necked dinosaurs, the sauropods that you talked about. Now, the interesting thing about the Morrison Formation is that it's mostly made of mudstones. And occasionally, you're going to come across these really hard, rounded cobbles made of quartzite and other hard rocks that really look out of place. And sometimes it's really difficult to see where those could possibly come from in the local area. Now, way before this study, people have hypothesized that those are actually what are called gastroliths. And gastroliths are stomach stones or stones that animals will eat to help them digest. Dinosaurs, unlike mammals, couldn't actually chew their food and digest it in the same way as, for example, cows could. So we think these sauropods and other dinosaurs would actually swallow these rocks to help grind down that plant material, and that those weird-looking stones in the rocks of the Morrison Formation are actually gastroliths.
Yeah, and this is not uncommon. I understand some birds will do this. They get some rocks down in their gizzards, and birds are just dinosaurs, really, or heavily evolved dinosaurs. So this idea isn't so weird that rocks could be traveling around by dinosaur.
No, it's not weird at all. As you mentioned, birds as well as crocodilians have been found with rocks in their stomachs, which are the closest living relatives to these dinosaurs. And we even have some dinosaurs, fossils that have been found with rocks in the right position to be these gastroliths. So it's really quite possible that those weird rocks were at one time inside a dinosaur.
Okay, but why are we thinking these weird rocks that may have been in a dinosaur ended up Wyoming? Why are we connecting them to Wisconsin?
See, that's really where this paper gets interesting. And it's because those rocks are a distinct texture and they're a distinct color. They're red quartzite. And quartzite is a metamorphic rock that used to be sand or sandstone. And it's become very, very hard. In fact, quartzite is some of the hardest rock in the entire world. Now, the red quartzite is unique because a lot of the quartzites around that area out west aren't that deep red color. Here in Wisconsin, however, we actually have red quartzites that everyone in the state could go visit at Devil's Lake State Park, what we call the Baraboo quartzite. And these quartzites are about 1.65 billion years old. And they get their red color because they actually have hematite or iron in them, which gives them that sort of distinctive color. So researchers for this paper actually looked at zircons inside those quartzite pebbles, the red quartzites in particular, in order to reconstruct an age of those rocks. And they noticed that the age of the isotopes that they studied match up very well with the age of the Baraboo quartzite from right here in Wisconsin, and don't actually match that well with quartzites closer to Wyoming. So they're hypothesizing that those rocks were originally from Wisconsin.
Okay, now did we previously have the notion that some of these big guy dinosaurs would go on a 1,000-mile walkabout?
So we didn't know that they would walk quite that far. That's actually a very long journey, even for a big sauropod dinosaur. There have been studies that have looked at the oxygen isotopes of teeth of sauropod dinosaurs and have come to the conclusion that they may have migrated maybe as much as 300 kilometers or so upland versus lowland. And this may be related to breeding habitat for nesting or in search of food. So this would be actually quite a bit longer ways for that, but it's quite a bit possible. We really don't know a lot about the biology and the behavior of these gigantic creatures. So it's not re out of the realm of reality that they could be doing this.
We're talking to Joseph Frederickson from the Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric past and this new research showing that maybe these big sauropods went from Wisconsin to Wyoming. Evidence maybe in these rocks, these quartzite rocks along the way. Let's bring on a caller. Pete is with us in Eau Claire. Pete, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Pete?
I found a piece of petrified wood yesterday.
Cool.
Oh.
Pretty old. Are you a fossil hunter yourself, Pete?
I'm more of an agate guy, but I'm always kind of on the lookout for anything. So it's my first piece that I found in Wisconsin. I found some nice big pieces out in Wyoming around 2012 when I worked out there. But kind of made my day. It's got some good colors in it. It's got some red, which I believe is from the iron. So it was pretty interesting.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. Is this a common find, Joseph, here in Wisconsin, the petrified wood?
Actually, it's not. Petrified wood is very common out west in places like the Morrison Formation of Jurassic Age or Cretaceous in age. So, the time of the dinosaurs, you get a lot of petrified wood in those formations. But surprisingly, in Wisconsin, we actually don't have any rocks from that time period. We're missing the entire Mesozoic era, the time of the dinosaurs, in our fossil record. And that's largely because when the glaciers came through, in the last ice age, about 20,000 years ago, they scraped all of the rocks clean off of Wisconsin and only left rocks that are older than about 385 million years ago. And during that time, which we call the Devonian period, there were plants on land, but most of Wisconsin was actually deep underwater, or at least underwater in a warm, shallow seaway. So you'd only get the plants that would actually died and floated out into the water and were later buried, would you actually find those?
Thanks a lot for that call. And I wanted to ask about our absence of dinosaur fossils here in Wisconsin. Now, as I understand it, for at least some of the dinosaur era, some of Wisconsin would have been land. It wouldn't have just been water. Presumably, dinosaurs could have lived here, but if they did, we got nothing to show for it. Is that right?
Exactly. So we do have evidence of Wisconsin being underwater from about 500 million years ago to about 385 million years ago, and then we lose the record. But if we look at states that are neighboring Wisconsin or ones out west, we can see that by the time of the dinosaurs, Wisconsin would have largely been on land, and we would have been situated pretty much between the Appalachian Mountains and the rising Rocky Mountains to the west. And in between that, we would have had some lowland, but it mostly would have been largely flat. So there wouldn't have been a place for there to be burial of fossils. And most of those rocks of the right age from the Jurassic or the Cretaceous largely eroded away before we could have a chance to study them. So we don't have a good record of dinosaurs here in Wisconsin. That's not to say that there aren't any rocks. There have been Cretaceous-aged rocks that have been mixed in with cobbles from the Ice Age that have been found out west in Wisconsin, but so far, really, it's been limited to plant fossils that have been found in those, and so far, no dinosaurs yet.
We're listening back to my conversation with Joseph Frederickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh. We talked in April about research into the migratory habits of dinosaurs and why we don't know a lot about dinosaur prehistory here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll hear from some fossil hunters in the state who have questions about what they've found in the field and where they can take their finds to get properly identified. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue listening to my conversation with Joseph Frederickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum. I talked to him back in April about what life looked like in Wisconsin tens of millions of years ago. To kick off the second half of the conversation, we hear from Greg in Waukesha, who called in to ask about the geological barriers potentially facing a dinosaur as it migrated from Wisconsin to Wyoming.
You know, I'm really trying to bend my mind around a dinosaur that size walking 1,000 miles. The other thing that is in my mind, isn't there a mountain range that they'd have to cross? And I don't think they like high elevations where it gets cold.
Interesting questions, Greg. Now, there's a mountain range now. Was there necessarily one there then, Joseph?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, the Rocky Mountains and a lot of the mountains that you have around there were actually formed after the Morrison Formation was deposited in the Cretaceous period. So they could be as much as 60 million years younger than the dinosaurs. So at the time, we would actually have seen fairly flat land between Wyoming and Wisconsin, with most of the highlands being to the west of Wyoming and to the east of Wisconsin. The paper actually does bring in the possibility that there was a river that actually ran between the Appalachians all the way to Wyoming, basically cutting through Wisconsin, and may have actually picked up some of these stones along the way, meaning that these dinosaurs may not have actually had to walk all the way to Wisconsin to get them. They might have been able to pick them up somewhere downstream before that river flowed into Wyoming.
Thanks for that call. I'm going to stick with Wisconsin, though. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Racine. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a beachcomber, and I have found lots of crinoids and shells that are from that period. However, I found some things that are kind of odd, like something that looks like it would be a hoof, but it's petrified. And a piece of a jawbone and what looks like a petrified knuckle bone, but I can't tell. It's a different size than I would expect to see on anything. So where could I find out? Could I send a picture someplace? Is there someplace that I can find out what these things might be?
Interesting, Chris. Is there a place where, you know, people out there finding things like this, Joseph, could go to identify them?
Bring them to the museum, the Weiser Science Museum. I'm happy to identify them. I'm a paleontologist by trade, and part of what we do for the public is actually identify these really cool finds, because as paleontologists, we can't be everywhere. It's actually much more common for people who have an interest in rock hunting to pick these things up and bring them to us, and who knows, they might be very, very important. As you said, the crinoids are very, very ancient that you'll find on the beaches around Lake Michigan. Some of those date back to around 420 million years ago, well before the dinosaurs. But it sounds like the bones that you have, including the hoof or the knuckle bone, might actually be of the Ice Age, about 20,000 years old or somewhere around there, and could be from some of the animals, the mammals that were walking around here as the glaciers were retreating, not as long ago as some of those other fossils.
Great question, Chris. And I know from visits to geology museums, Joseph, that, well, we don't necessarily have a lot in the way of dinosaur remains here in Wisconsin. Those more recent guys you were talking about, the Ice Age people, we had, mammoths and things like that. Can you talk about where we do have more abundant fossil records in the state?
So our fossil record is the really old stuff and the really young stuff. So the animal fossils begin about 500 million years ago in what we call the Cambrian period. And these will include things like trilobites, but also trackways of some of the first animals to crawl out of the ocean and onto land. Around 385 million years ago in the Devonian period, which is also known as the Age of Fish, we had some really cool animals, including large armored fish swimming around the oceans of Milwaukee. And then we have that gap where we really have a lack of knowledge of what was here. But we picked that back up at the Ice Age about 20,000 years ago. And as you said, we have mammoths. We had mastodons that would have been walking around in our own backyard. But we also had some more interesting creatures, I think, like a giant bear-sized beaver called Castoroides. That was here, as well as the possibility of direwolves, large saber-toothed cats, and even ground sloths would have been in the area.
We're talking to Joseph Frederickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric history. Our starting point today, this research saying maybe some of these dinosaurs wandered from Wisconsin to Wyoming. You mentioned there the oceans of Milwaukee. And that, you know, that's kind of mind-blowing to think about. Can you talk about how much this spot on Earth we call Wisconsin has changed over the eons?
It has changed tremendously. As I mentioned, the rocks in question of this study from the Baraboo quartzite are 1.65 billion years old. Now, the sand to make that quartzite actually comes from mountains that were actually in northern Wisconsin. And we actually can imagine having a mountain range actually cutting through the state. More recently, when we actually would have some of these animal fossils, like during the Cambrian or Devonian periods, Wisconsin was actually positioned south of the equator, and the entire continent was turned clockwise so that what would be where Lake Michigan is now would actually be to our south. So Wisconsin was actually much warmer back then, and it was actually under a shallow seaway, so warm that we would actually have coral reefs growing in the state.
And there is, I ran across this, and I keep meaning to actually have a guest on to talk about this in specific. There's a geologic era named after Wisconsin, the Wisconsinian or Wisconsinian era or period or something like that. That's all I know. Is that a thing?
Yes, it actually is. So it's a little bit, it's not quite as extensive as an era. It's actually a stage within the last ice age. Essentially, the last ice age, when that last lobe of the glacier came down from Canada, it essentially stopped in its tracks right in the middle of Wisconsin. And that's why we have what's called the Driftless Area in the west that looks on a map way different than the rest of Wisconsin does to the east. And it lacks all the features that are created by glaciers, like the lakes that you see dotting all over eastern and northern Wisconsin. And geologists name those time periods in the glaciation cycles based on where you can see the evidence of them best. So previous to the Wisconsin, you have some that were in Illinois and Nebraska and Kansas, which are named for those states respectively. But the last one, and probably the most impressive one, is from Wisconsin.
And Joseph, in our last couple of minutes, I want to get back to dinosaurs in Wisconsin. We can be pretty sure they were here, even though we don't have much in the way of direct evidence. With a study like this showing Wisconsin rocks maybe traveling by dinosaur stomach or gizzard or something, are you hopeful that we can get indirect evidence that could help establish what kind of creatures we had here?
Absolutely. There's really no reason to believe that the dinosaurs that we have in Wyoming wouldn't be the exact same ones that we would find in Wisconsin. There wasn't any clear barrier that was keeping them out. So this study, I think it's really nice because it's a reminder to us of how interconnected just the continent would have been during the Jurassic. And it also helps us here in Wisconsin, you know, feel like we're a part of that fossil record, because you know, there's no Jurassic sediments here in Wisconsin, but at least there's a little part of Wisconsin in the Jurassic sediments.
What can we see online right now at the Weiss Museum, whether we're in town or far away, just in our last few moments?
So we are open on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and we have a brand new exhibit called Animals Through Time that talks about the evolution of animals from the Precambrian all the way through the modern record. And that was part of a big donation that was given to us by Bruce Danz, a local collector and physician in the Appleton area. Online, we do have a YouTube page where we're actually updating virtual field trips that go to different parts of the state and show you some of the geologic history. Right now, we have one from Sheridan Park in Cudahy that looks at the glacial record of hills that you'll see around there, as well as one in Mosinee County looking at Blackberry Hill, which is from the Cambrian period and has evidence of some of those first animals to crawl out of the ocean and leave trackways in the rocks that you can still see today.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh. I talked to him in April about the discovery of rocks unique to Wisconsin winding up in Wyoming. and that the theory that dinosaurs may have transported those rocks in their stomachs as they migrated west millions of years ago. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll listen to my conversation with food writer and podcast host Julia Tertian about her latest cookbook, Simply Julia. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Join us every Friday at this time for great cooking advice, recipes, and more with Food Friday. And check out the huge archive of recipes we've built up over the years, from chickpea and yogurt soup to sour cream chocolate cake with peanut butter frosting and chocolate peanut butter glaze. Now, in her new cookbook, our next guest writes all about comfort food that's healthy, practical, and takes into account the realities of what it means to be a home cook, including how many dishes you'll have to do afterward. She says feeding yourself and feeding the ones you love should help solve stress, not create more. The book includes vegan and vegetarian options, 11 recipes for chicken, and a whole section dedicated to simple dressings and sauces. And she tackles what it means to nourish your body with food and your own relationship to food. Julia Tertian is a food writer, host of the podcast Keep Calm and Cook On, and author of several cookbooks. She also founded the inclusive digital directory of women and non-binary people in food called Equity at the Table. Her new cookbook is called Simply Julia, 110 Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. I talked to her earlier this spring about her cookbook and the benefits of comfort food. Here's that conversation. Before we get into some recipes from the book, Julia, I want to talk a little bit about your approach to food and health. This is something you've thought a lot about and talked a lot about. I know for a lot of us, our relationship with food starts in for different reasons with stress and anxiety. How are you trying to help us work through that?
Sure. You know, I really believe that the world is pretty stressful. Life is pretty stressful. And I think the kitchen is the last place where we need to experience stress. And I know that cooking at home is something that causes a lot of people a lot of anxiety. And for me, it's where I feel my calmest. You know, it's where I feel most in control, most capable of, you know, providing something really nourishing for myself and my family. So that's what I try to get across to my readers. And for me, that's part of just like a really healthy relationship to cooking and eating. And that's definitely what I consider to be part of what it is to be healthy, to have like an ease with just feeding yourself. I think, you know, in today's culture, cookbooks and food TV and stuff, I think a lot of people feel a little bit intimidated, feel like they have to make stuff really fancy or expensive. And I just think simple food is really good. And I think it's really valuable.
And let's talk about the concept of healthy comfort food. Because I know at different times in my life when I've been stressed, you know, comfort food might be an awesome bowl of soup that I made the other day. That's really healthy. Or at some points it might have been, you know, hitting those pizza rolls and throwing them in the toaster oven. That's, you know, yummy, but maybe not so healthy. How can we steer ourselves so that comfort response is still good stuff, even if it doesn't, as you say, take tons and tons of effort?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'm not mad at your pizza rolls. I think if they made you feel, you know, like happy and taken care of, I think that's valuable. I try not to assign food any label, like good or bad or clean or dirty or anything. I basically define healthy comfort food as food that makes us feel not just comforted, but comfortable. Like, when do you feel most comfortable in your body? You know, and maybe that's like a pizza roll now and then, and maybe it's some ice cream now and then. Maybe it's also, you know, like a really warm, nice bowl of soup, you know, a big thing of salad and vegetables that makes you feel really energized. You know, I think it's all these things. I think there's room for all of it. And I think it's just feeling, yeah, this combination of both comforted and comfortable.
Now we're going to hit a couple recipes in a minute. But Julia, one theme I got looking through a lot of your recipes is at first glance, oh, this looks like it's going to be complicated. And then I read the recipe and I keep wanting to turn the page. Oh, no, that was it. You really do try to make stuff that even, you know, not a pro, you know, a non-pro like me is going to be able to do and accomplish and have it come out pretty good.
Yeah, I'm really, really glad to hear that that came through. You know, this book is called Simply Julia, and, you know, it's really simple. These are really easy recipes. And I, you know, again, I just think stress is like the worst thing you could bring into your kitchen. And I think that really good, wonderful food is within all of our reach. I don't think things have to take a lot of time. I don't think you have to wash a lot of dishes, as you mentioned early on. Like, these things are really important to me because I think as home cooks, we do so much. You know, we're not just making the meal. We're also shopping for it. We're cleaning up. And I just want to make that experience as like easy and effortless as possible. So yeah, I'm glad the recipes felt like you could make them because, you know, I know you can. I know I don't really know you, but I know you can make them.
I really could, yeah. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Julia Tertian about her new cookbook, Simply Julia, 110 Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. Okay, Julia, you shared a few recipes with us. We've got these up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start with one of those chicken recipes I mentioned. This one is sticky chicken. Looks really good. Tell us the story behind this one.
Sure. So this was a dish that I tried for the first time. It was a number of years ago, about 8 years ago, and I was with my now wife, Grace, and we were on basically one of our like first dates, and we ended up at a friend of a friend's house, and that friend of a friend's mom served us what's called sticky chicken, and we just all loved it. And I just tracked down the recipe, and the version I offer in this cookbook is just, it's so simple and it's so good. I've heard from so many friends, especially with like little kids who are just like loving it. And you basically just cut up some chicken. You could use chicken breast or chicken thighs, whatever. You brown them in a pan with a little bit of oil and salt and pepper. And then you just add the sauce that's made of all like pantry staple ingredients, like a little bit of ketchup, a little garlic, a little soy sauce. It's just these really simple ingredients that come together to make this like sticky, delicious, like glaze on the chicken. And, you know, you can serve it with like a bunch of vegetables. There's extra sauce there, maybe some rice. And you'll have a really healthy, really fresh meal that took very little effort. But the sauce is so good. And it just makes it kind of fun and exciting. And to me, again, these are parts of what it feels like to feel healthy. It's to feel like you're having fun. You know, there's joy and pleasure. Like, to me, that's a huge part of healthy food. It shouldn't be like a punishment.
And you solve one of my most common pratfalls. When I cube chicken and then sear it in a pan, I'm not that bright. I'll put it in the pan. I'm like, oh, there's no room. I keep cramming it in there and then cooking. And then it like, you know, it takes too long and it doesn't get cooked evenly. You have this amazing solution where you do half of it, take out, and then do the other half. Just simple little tips like that can really save us a lot of heartache, it seems like.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're going to get more flavor because you'll get all that browned, you know, surface on the chicken as opposed to like steaming the chicken. And it's going to take the same amount of time because just as you said, if you cram it all into the pan at once, it's going to take longer. So you just split it into two and, you know, it works out. So, yeah, I'm glad that helped.
Is this something you do a lot? Like occasionally I'm able to solve my own problems, but do you like look for those like little simple fixes to solve those little everyday problems we might run into when we're cooking?
I mean, I think you just, you know, gave me my perfect way to describe what I do for a living. I've never said it that clearly. That's exactly what I do. And it's what I love to do. I take so much pleasure in figuring out those little moments because I think they help unlock the kitchen. You know, the only reason I know these things or think of them is because I've been cooking for so long. I've been a daily home cook for so many years and I've been interested in cooking my whole life. So that's the only thing that, you know, sets me apart maybe from anyone else is just how much time I've spent doing it. So I'm always looking for these little things. And it's what I love about cooking because you can find these little things like every day. It's really, I think it's fun.
We're listening to my Food Friday conversation with Julia Tertian, food writer, host of the podcast Keep Calm and Cook On. She joined us in March to talk about her latest cookbook, Simply Julia, 110 Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. Coming up, we'll get some more recipes from Julia, including one for an everything bagel hand pie. You won't want to miss it. There's more coming up in just a moment, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue listening now to an encore presentation of Food Friday. Today, we're listening to my conversation with Julia Tertian, host of the podcast Keep Calm and Cook On. She's the author of a bunch of books. Her latest cookbook is Simply Julia, 110 Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. Coming up in this half of the conversation, we take some listener calls, including a caller who wanted some macaroni and cheese tips. Here's the rest of that conversation. Julia, let's get into another one of those recipes you shared with us, these hand pies, everything bagel-style hand pies. And at first I pictured, oh, I'm just using bagels to make these? No, but you're coating them like that everything bagel. Tell us about these guys.
Sure. These are so fun. This is definitely one of the most fun recipes in the book. So you make this really, really simple dough. And this is a really great recipe if you are, you know, really interested in baking, but maybe you haven't had much experience or you're a little bit intimidated, because this is a very forgiving, very easy dough, very satisfying to make. So it's made of just some flour with a little, you know, salt and baking soda, and then just some yogurt. And you mix that together. You don't have to let it rise. Like, nothing needs to happen. You just mix it up like you're making, you know, Play-Doh. And then you roll it out into circles, and you fill each one with a mixture of scrambled eggs and scallions. That said, you could fill these with anything. Mm-hmm. I wanted these to be like a breakfast hand pie, but you could do like vegetables and cheese, whatever you want. You're making like a little calzone, basically. So then you fold over the dough like a, you know, kind of like a half moon, and you brush it with some egg, and you sprinkle it with everything bagel seasoning, which you can buy from the store. You know, it's pretty available these days, or you can, you know, mix up your own. You pop them in the oven, and it is just, it's the most wonderful, like, handheld, totally portable breakfast. Everyone loves these, and it's really nice because you can customize them. You know, you could add bacon to someone's, you could add cheese, you know, you can make it whatever you want.
And that's going to impress people, right? Because I've been at, like, fancy little bakeries that sell hand pies, and, like, they're the awesomest things in the world when I buy them. So are people pretty blown away when you just serve them up at a table?
I really feel like people are, and they're surprised by them, which is like a really nice feeling, you know, like it's, you know, it's breakfast, it's eggs and basically a little bread, you know, like toast or a bagel, but it's so fun and it just takes people by surprise. And I just think that's a really nice feeling to offer.
That's pretty cool. And now, speaking of breakfast, you've got the other recipe you shared with us is on that magical borderline between breakfast and dessert. And I'm always happy to be there. The orange and Greek yogurt cake. And this one mixes, it looks like it's easier or as easy to make as like a zucchini bread. Easier because you don't have to grate a zucchini.
Exactly.
Tell us about this cake.
Exactly. You took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. Yeah, this is exactly as you described. It's so easy to make. And it's like a, you know, a nice kind of quick bread, like a loaf, exactly like a zucchini bread, a banana bread in that spirit. And it's made really simply of just some eggs, again, some Greek yogurt, a little olive oil is in this, which keeps it really moist. And then you add some fresh orange juice and zest. I just combined those words. and just enough sugar just to make it a little bit sweet. So it really is, you know, on that line between breakfast and dessert, which I'm with you. I like to be at that line at all times. And, you know, bind it together with a little flour, throw it in your loaf pan, bake it. It's so simple. You could also make this into muffins if you'd like. And then you can eat it just as is. It's great with, you know, coffee or tea or whatever. But you can also put a little bit extra yogurt and sliced oranges onto each slice to make it just seem like a little bit more special. But, you know, it's using the ingredients you already bought to make it. So it's great. This is also like a great thing to drop off for, I don't know, like maybe a neighbor who's done you a favor, or, you know, a friend or something like that. It makes a really nice little gift.
We heard from Janet in Winona, Minnesota, who wants some ideas for things to make for someone who's lactose intolerant and has a wheat allergy. Wow, that narrows things down. I don't know if you specialize in that kind of you know, cooking for people with specific allergies, but Julia, does anything leap to mind?
Oh, for sure. You know, I actually organized in the back of the book, because I know a lot of people live with, you know, whether it's allergies or restrictions of any sort like this. So I actually organized all the recipes in the back of the book so you can look through all the vegetarian recipes, all the gluten-free recipes, you know, all the vegan ones and so on. So tons of ideas. Do you know, is she looking for something sweet or savory, or doesn't matter?
Oh, how about one of each? She dropped off her line. I think we're having some phone trouble. But anyway,
Right.
How about one of each?
Yeah, sure. Happily. Okay. So savory, the first thing that comes to mind, I did a recipe for chili in this book that I called the best vegan chili because I really believe it is. And I'll tell you, my best friend recently made it and she didn't tell her husband it was vegan. She just said, you know, we're having chili. And he like loved it. And he was like, this is so good. And then she told him that there was no meat in it. And he like didn't believe her. So I feel like that's a good advertisement if, you know, if you've never had vegan chili before. It's so simple to make. It's filled with wonderful spices and it's really, really good. And yeah, that includes no wheat, no dairy. So if they're lactose intolerant, no problem. And then for something sweet, what should we do? I would say there's a blueberry crumble recipe in the book, and you can use frozen blueberries for that, which makes it like even easier. And the topping is a mixture of oats and whole wheat flour. So she could just use all oats, just skip the flour. And then you can use, you know, I call for butter, but some people who are lactose intolerant can tolerate that. And if not, they could just use a little coconut oil or olive oil, you know, any fat really. And that would be delicious. It's almost like an oatmeal cookie on top of like blueberry pie filling. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Hope that helps. We're talking to Julia Tershin, author of the new cookbook, Simply Julia, 110 Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. She's also host of the podcast, Keep Calm and Cook On. Now, you've also got a lot of, I see, dressing recipes in the book, including a go-to with just a few ingredients. Talk about some of your favorite dressings.
Sure. Yeah, I included an entire chapter of really easy, like, salad dressings and just quick little sauces and relishes, because I think that's what sets most really good meals apart from meals that are just okay. You know, it's just like a spoonful of something special. So you mentioned the go-to dressing. This is truly my go-to dressing. You know, that's why I called it that. And it's really easy to remember because it's only four ingredients and you use equal parts of each of these ingredients. So it's olive oil, tahini, soy sauce, and apple cider vinegar. I almost forgot the fourth. And what's great about it being equal parts of each is, you know, you could do a spoonful of each if you're just making, you know, like a salad for yourself, or I don't know, if you're cooking for a huge group of people, you could do it, you know, by the bottle. So it's really easy to scale up or down, and it just goes well on everything. If it, you're eating like a simple salad of just, you know, like lettuce and cucumbers, it's great, but it's also great used as a sauce on something like, you know, roasted chicken or grilled fish. It's great mixed into cooked rice. It's like so versatile. You can keep it in a jar in your fridge, you know, for like a week or probably even a little more than that. Great on roasted vegetables. It's just so good. And you don't have to chop anything. You know, it's all things that are just in bottles or jars in your pantry. So you just whisk them together.
And Julia, you know, we've been focusing a lot on the food, and I think we're all hoping to, you know, be able to have meals together with lots of other humans again fairly soon in our lives. And in case we forgot what we do at these, you included some meaningful conversation prompts to get us started. You know, I feel like I might need some of those when I'm there are other non-nuclear family members around the table with me. What kind of things do you offer up?
Sure. Yeah, this is included in a list of just other sort of helpful lists at the back of the book. And I, you know, when I wrote the book, I had no idea that it would be coming out during, you know, on the year anniversary, basically, of a pandemic. But I found that these questions are useful, not just when you're eating together, but I don't know, if you're on Zoom with your family and you don't really know what to talk about because not much is happening, they're good for that, good for a long car ride. So they're just questions to sort of prompt meaningful conversation, because to me, that's the best part about eating together. So some of the questions include, you know, like, what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up? That's a really great question to ask, especially much older people in your life. It always leads to great stories. What else? I ask, you know, for you to ask whoever you're with to ask them who's someone you want to write a thank you note to. What would you tell that person? So, you know, big sort of broad questions that apply to everyone, but it leads to really good conversation.
Ooh, we finally got a caller who made it through our phone system here. Chris is with us in Racine. Chris, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It came a very good timing because I have a day that needs comfort. And my favorite is macaroni and cheese as a go-to comfort food. And I just use Campbell's food and sharp cheddar cheese and mix it all together with milk and elbow. But do you have a special recipe for macaroni and cheese?
Chris, thanks for that call. Just in our last 30 seconds or so, Julia, give us a great mac and cheese tip.
Sure. I mean, I love mac and cheese. There's a recipe in Simply Julia for a ratatouille baked pasta. So you basically roast off a bunch of vegetables on a sheet pan, mix it with some cooked pasta and some cheese. I use ricotta and some mozzarella. And then you put it right back on the sheet pan and bake it so it gets really nice and crispy. So it's sort of a mac and cheese-ish kind of thing with tons of vegetables. So it's a really nice kind of healthy comfort food spin on a pretty classic comfort food.
Thanks for that call. And Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
That was Julia Tertian. She's a food writer, host of the podcast Keep Calm and Cook On, and author of several cookbooks. She founded the inclusive digital directory of women and non-binary people in food called Equity at the Table. We talked back in March about her latest cookbook, Simply Julia, 110 Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food. You can find recipes from Simply Julia, including the ones for sticky chicken and everything bagel hand pies at WPR.org/Food Friday. If you have a suggestion or an idea for an upcoming Food Friday, feel free to email us at ideas@WPR.org. Coming up next week on Central Time, we'll check in on the latest happenings in national politics in our weekly Week in Washington segment. And on Tuesday, do you miss crowds or are you a little overwhelmed by the idea of being in large gatherings? Either way, you're not alone. Psychologist Regan Goering is back with us for a look at the return to public gatherings and what we think about them. That and more coming up next week here on Central Time. Suppose you're getting ready to play a round of pinball. You search your pockets for a coin or two. You could use everyday quarters, but you could also be a genuine pinball wizard by using a new coin in honor of the band behind the song of that name, The Who. But don't do that. It would be an expensive game of pinball. The Royal Mint of the UK announced the release of a new coin this year, a coin honoring The Who. The denomination of the coin, it's not just tuppence and sixpence, it's £5. That's just over $7 American. A little steep for that game of pinball. Plus, it's more of a collectible. It's selling actually for £22.5, over $30. According to the Royal Mint website, it features a design personally approved by the band. The Who was initially known for its loud, brash, anarchic style. So is an official government coin the best way to honor them? Or did The Who sell out? I won't weigh in on that. All I could say is, I hope it appreciates in value before it gets old. This is Central Time. Ever since I was a young boy.